You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here is your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Julie Broadway, president of the American Horse Council.
And I'm Emily Stearns, health, welfare, and regulatory affairs liaison for the American Horse Council.
And you're listening to the special monthly American Horse Council episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for June of 2026. My gosh, Emily, where has the year gone?
I know.
Horse world.
It's time to hear from the American Horse Council in this monthly episode of Horses in the Morning.
As we've just come off a fantastic Derby run, we felt like it was worth jumping into a topic that the American Horse Council has been working hard to address for the last several years, and that's the issue of bush tracks. Now, for folks that aren't familiar, bush tracks are places where unsanctioned horse racing takes place. And these races are nothing like a sanctioned race and absolutely nothing like the Derby.
Yeah, they're essentially like the lawless Wild West of racing.
Yeah, these horses and jockeys race without any oversight of their state racing commissions, no industry rules, no safety regulations. There's some gross mishandling of the animals and a host of other what we believe to be criminal activities, oftentimes housing illegal gambling and doping rings and all kinds of things.
And on my side, we get especially concerned about, you know, particularly the health and welfare of these horses. We have, you know, we'll talk about the documented evidence of major disease outbreaks. We have electroshock devices, death and injury to humans and horses. It's really kind of a mixing pot of horribleness.
Yeah. And none of this would be tolerated, of course, at a sanctioned racetrack. And if this illicit industry is allowed to thrive, it will kill, we fear, legitimate racing, both reputationally and in merit. People in the general public don't distinguish between unsanctioned and sanctioned racing. So there's a lot of overlap and bleed over in what the public's perception is about what takes place.
Yeah, we talk about social license a lot. So the integrity of horse racing is really vital to its success. And this kind of goes everything the industry has worked to improve for the sport and competition and the health and welfare side of it.
Yeah, and these kinds of operations don't reflect the standards of the legitimate industry. We want to be clear that this is something the industry takes very seriously and that we're calling for action, including renewed investigation and enforcement from the Department of Justice to address illegal bush track racing. So today's episode, we will hear from some graduate students that we've had working on this. So, Dietrich, we're happy to have you with us. And we're sorry, Sophia, I had a last-minute cancellation, but I'm glad you're going to be able to speak for both of you. And Amanda Cadillac, who is AHC's government affairs liaison, was their mentor on this project. So we're going to hear from Amanda. And they've done quite an extensive amount of research, still some more work to do. And we're trying to develop some ways to address this sort of shadow tracks, if you will. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Poplas. And from a world-class equestrian facilities, race courses, exhibition buildings, and entertainment venues, the team at Poplas uses its world-renowned expertise to create some of the most recognizable, immersible equine and entertainment experiences across the globe. From Churchill Downs to the new Belmont Park, which is beautiful, folks, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo to the Calgary Stampede, Poplas specializes in planning, design, and development of the world's foremost equestrian and livestock venues. You can learn more about them by visiting poplas.com. So thanks for joining us to talk about this growing concern. So let's start with some introductions. So Amanda, why don't you introduce yourself first, and then we'll move to Aditri. And Aditri, say a few words about Sophia so we don't lose her out of this conversation.
Thank you, Julie. Like Julie said, my name is Amanda Cadillac. I'm the government affairs liaison with the American Horse Council. I am coming up in July on my one-year anniversary with the council. And when I started almost a year ago, I inherited Aditri and Sophia as my interns. They were hard at work on this project already and kind of read me into what was going on around the country. And I have kind of stepped into the role over the past year and developed it even further. And Aditri, would you like to introduce yourself and talk about Sophia a little bit?
Yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Aditri Singh. I just finished up my junior year of undergrad at Rutgers University, so I'm about to be a senior in college. And Sophia is a current law student at Fordham University, which is very exciting. My background in horses was a lot less law and policy and a lot more hands-on in veterinary medicine and welfare until Sophia and I started to intern at the American Horse Council. And we started looking into bush track racing, and I'm sure we'll get more into that and all of our work and the work that is still to be done. But we are both very grateful for this opportunity and to be back this summer to help continue some of our work. So we're very, very excited.
Well, thank you all for joining us. So Amanda, we're going to start with you. Why don't you go ahead and just kind of give us the lowdown? How extensive is this issue?
So this is a lot bigger and a lot more organized than people tend to assume. Unsanctioned racing has been around forever, but what's changed most recently is its scale and speed. Today, we're talking about an underground system that operates across dozens of states, moves quickly, and is incredibly easy to promote. And that's largely due to social media, which has completely changed the game. It has allowed organizers to advertise races, line up matches, set purses, and coordinate betting in just a matter of hours. And then they can disappear just as quickly. Investigators have identified nearly 200 known bush tracks across at least 30 states. And those are mostly in the South and Southwest, but it can happen anywhere. And that's just what we can see. There's no formal reporting, no paperwork, no oversight. So the true scope is likely much larger. This is just what we've been able to piecemeal together through official reports from agencies and such.
When you say over 200 tracks, are they like clustered in circuits or are they just kind of spread out evenly across that Southwest region?
I would say they're probably evenly spread out. So I gave a speech recently in Indiana to Racing Commission, and I brought examples of race flyers and I linked them to the locations where these races were going to be taking place. And when you look at the locations on Google Maps, you zoom out just a couple clicks and these tracks just disappear into the landscape. They really are just all over. And I think that's why it's so hard to really track them down and get these things to stop.
Yikes. Okay. So Aditri, going to the work you and Sophia have done, how did you guys go about kind of identifying the issue? And what really, you know, in terms of looking at everything, what really shocked you the most about the problem?
Yeah, so when Sophia and I started looking at this issue, we were lucky enough that the American Horse Council did have some like preliminary data that we were able to sort of like dig through and kind of see what tracks had been identified or suspected already. And we realized pretty quickly that a single model resolution for each state would not really be useful for this situation. It looked good on paper, but it didn't really reflect the reality on the ground, as Amanda mentioned, like just the way the tracks are located, how shady some of the events can be, and just it's not a super common issue that I think a lot of people in the horse community even know about. And every state is different just in terms of state laws, the type of track they have. So some states already had animal cruelty laws that could apply to bush track racing, but the enforcement of those laws were weak, so they weren't really doing anyone any good. Others had gaps around illegal gambling, unregulated racing, drugging, veterinary oversight, or cross-jurisdictional coordination. And not every problem was a pure legal issue. Sometimes the issue was just enforcement, which is a whole beast of its own because there were sort of legislative resolutions, but how are you going to get people to, you know, enforce them and keep them up to date? Sometimes it was an education, reporting, budget or like a lack of a centralized system that could identify patterns and repeat offenders. So Sophia and I's approach was to diagnose the issue state by state before proposing language, and we wanted the model resolutions to complement what a state already had. So we looked a lot into chicken fighting laws and regulations, as well as dog fighting. That was sort of like the similar analogy we were able to draw and see what had worked in those cases, what didn't work, what we could take, what we could adjust and amend on. And we were able to substitute for things that were missing and give legislators something practical rather than symbolic, especially being like, you know, students, we liked something a little more serious so people would take us seriously. And we also asked ourselves what current technology we could use and we could apply to this problem in a meaningful way, given how much enforcement depends on detection, documentation, information sharing. We considered whether technology could help identify patterns, it could centralize reports, it could track repeat offenders, and give both sides of the agencies better tools to respond before the harm spreads. And what shocked us the most with this issue was how it was so much bigger than just illegal racing alone. Once you have underground events involving cash, gambling, there was no oversight and no veterinary control, it sort of unveiled this entire ecosystem of illegal activity that was complemented with animal cruelty, dog fighting, trafficking, drugging, illegal betting, and potentially organized criminal conduct. So in a way, it sort of felt like opening Pandora's box. The horse was the visible and maybe like our first preliminary victim, but the activity that we were able to discover through our research showed how much more harm has potential to happen. And it
just hold on. I'm gonna pause you there. There's so much information to get through. Yeah. So it just feels like just based on that amount of explanation, like, one, like you said, opening Pandora's box, and we'll get into that a little bit more, but two, kind of like whack-a-mole. So even if there is enforcement, they're just gonna pop up again somewhere else even.
Yeah, definitely. And if I can interject a little bit colloquially, that same conference I mentioned earlier, somebody in the audience came up to me after my speech and was saying, you know, if a horse gets put on a vet list in one state, and it's very hard to get a horse off of a vet list sometimes, they'll just take that horse to an underground circuit in another state just to try to recoup some of the money they spent on that horse. So
to clarify what Amanda just said, so she's saying that if a horse at a regulated sanctioned race, whether that's a thoroughbred race or a quarter horse race or a harness race, gets injured and put on a vet list or flagged and put on a vet list, that they're likely to just, if they know of an unsanctioned event, just to take that horse off to an unsanctioned event and race anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. So my next question was going to be about the implications on sanctioned racing, but that's a great lead-in, which is what we tend to see is some of these horses move from unsanctioned to sanctioned and back and forth. And initially, Dr. Angela Pella-McCluskey from USDA flagged this because she was seeing some disease migration. They would go to an unsanctioned event, they might share needles, horses would get infected, then they'd go back to their home barn where they might be stabled with horses that were in sanctioned races, but they were touching and they were getting in around each other to the point that they were spreading all these diseases. So this isn't just about public perception and the implications, but it's a real, concrete issue that we're facing in the industry, I think, to try to minimize disease outbreak.
And I'd like to clarify further on that before we let Amanda and Aditri rip on this topic, because if you listen to Dr. Pelzel-McCluskey talk about this issue, to clarify, we had basically almost eliminated equine infectious anemia, EIA, which is what your Coggins test tests for. We had almost eliminated that in the United States. We are now seeing a resurgence. And Julie, what is it like? 90 to 95% of these cases are coming from needle sharing in these bush track horses. And if you know anything about that outbreak that happened in Texas at that vet clinic, that was also through needle sharing. And they think patient zero was probably a horse that had contact with one of these unsanctioned racing horses.
And I think that even, in cases like some of the more recent EHV1 outbreaks, those are known horses, known populations. So, you would think it might be easier to do contact tracing, but it's still difficult. And those are horses you can track down, their owners and trainers, and let them know. These horses that we're talking about that participate in unsanctioned races, there's no telling who they are, where they come from, or tracking them whatsoever.
That leads into the illegal imports aspect of it too, because Julie and I have talked about that before on the show, of what's happening with illegal horse imports, the closure of the Mexican border, things like that. But a not insignificant portion are these bush track horses, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Well, and not to digress from our topic, but as we also think about New World screwworm coming in, this is becoming more and more of a concern and something that we really need to find solutions to mitigate as quickly as we can, because this could get ugly in a hurry. Uglier, I guess I should say.
Especially since the more prevalent races happen in the South and Southwest, you know, kind of more so along our southern border, where screwworm is most likely to enter the country. It's very, very scary.
Amanda, what do you see are some of the other implications on sanctioned racing? I know when you talked to the racing commissioners, they were shocked about how much betting was going on in unsanctioned, right, which could have been betting that went on at sanctioned tracks. So this is drawing away from their revenue stream, so to speak, a little bit.
Yeah, because wagering at bush tracks completely off the books. So that means there's no takeout, no purses, no tax revenue, and also no support for the backstretch workers or breeders or anybody else. So it is money being directly siphoned straight out of the regulated system, which is already facing challenges. Second, as Emily was alluding to, is horse health and welfare. So like we mentioned, these races happen with no oversight, no medication controls, no disease testing. So you could have a horse participate on a bush track one weekend and show up at a licensed facility the next. And that means the regulators at that track, at the sanctioned track, are completely blind to what that horse was exposed to the week prior. So that's a huge biosecurity risk. And lastly, I just want to reiterate the damage to the reputation of legitimate sanctioned racing, because like Julie mentioned towards the beginning, when videos of injuries or abuse go viral, the public really does not distinguish between legal and illegal. All racing gets painted by that same brush. Mm-hmm. So that reputational damage lands on the regulators, on lawmakers, and on everyone working legitimately in the sport.
And remind me, Amanda, I'm going to get this wrong. I know we've seen videos of horses that have been severely injured and had to be put down. But we've also seen a couple of jockeys at unsanctioned tracks who have gotten seriously injured.
Yeah, I try not to look for those videos so much. But in doing the research to prepare for my speech in Indiana, I did look at some pretty gross videos of horses, you know, taking tumble head over foot and the jockeys just left in the dirt, kind of unmoving. And then the video just ends. So I have no idea what happened to that poor jockey after that. But, you know, that's the sad reality, because they push these horses. So what they will do is, The drug cocktail that they inject these horses with is largely methamphetamines mixed with cocaine in order to mask pain and improve performance. So if these horses stumble or injure themselves, or just, you know, they can't go anymore and they break down, it's a huge problem for everyone.
Let's talk a minute about our strategy, because when we first started this whole project, we went to state attorney generals.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned you spoke to the racing commissions. Bridget, when she was still with us, she spoke at the National Sheriff's Association. Talk a little bit about how many different agencies and all the ways we've tried to get people or organizations involved in working with us on this.
Yeah. So as Aditri mentioned, you know, this touches so many factors. So it sits at the intersection of racing regulation, animal welfare, law enforcement, and gambling oversight. So you have so many different groups who have a piece of the pie there. So it's required us to have conversations kind of across the board. I mentioned I just spoke to the Association of Racing Commissioners. I also recently spoke to the National Governors Association, or no, I'm sorry, National Sheriffs Association at a conference they had in DC. And what's become really clear is there's no single agency that sees the full picture. Commissioners might see licensee crossover, and they might be able to ban a jockey who's been proven to participate in unsanctioned racing. But then law enforcement officials may only see the gambling and drug violations, and the animal welfare officials may only see neglected horses. And therefore, the dots don't always get connected between the different factors. So I think our role has really been at the American Horse Council to help bridge the gaps. And that's kind of what we're trying to do, following the wonderful research that Aditri and Sophia started and have continued. Our racing committee has propped up a working group on unsanctioned racing. And we just had our first call a couple weeks ago. And one of the things they charged me with doing was taking the pulse of Congress to see if there was any kind of federal appetite for either legislation or regulatory action. So that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, I think some more about, I mean, the FBI has been involved in a couple of raids some tracks, but it's been really hard to prosecute some of those things. But I was shocked when we heard our last report from Aditri and Sophia to learn this has gotten so sophisticated that now they have an app on their phone and they're betting with cryptocurrency and they're doing all kinds of interesting money laundering kind of shell games at these unsanctioned tracks. I have a colleague who said they were visiting a community and they saw a sign up on a little corner board about a race and they decided they would go. And they said, this is nothing small. There were 500 people at least at this little pop-up track that was doing this. And they said they couldn't hardly watch because it was really, really sad to see some of the things that were going on there. But it's amazing to me how deep and how wide this issue is.
I might ask too, and Aditri, feel free to chime in on this. So have we seen any successful enforcement? I feel like we've talked about how difficult enforcement is, and we've talked about whether it should be at the state or federal level. But what has been successful in terms of enforcement?
I will just offer that California Horse Racing Board has recently issued a lifetime ban to a licensed jockey that they found had participated in unsanctioned racing. So it seems like in states where racing commissions are strong, they have the ability to do these kind of things. It seems that in states where maybe there isn't a commission or racing isn't as prevalent, that there's still work to be done. I don't know, Aditri, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think what Amanda said is right. It still doesn't feel like states as a whole might be like able to enforce certain laws, but there are like situational things, like when they do find a jockey or they find like one specific case to kind of show like, you know, they are paying attention to it. But I think what a big part of ending bush track racing is going to be is things like EIA, equine infectious anemia. Ironically, sometimes it's hard to get people to care about things that don't directly impact them. But then when you put it into that light, like, hey, if we have a horse at an unsanctioned race and a sanctioned race the next week and you don't know where that horse has been, your own racehorse is at risk. So I think angles like that can sometimes be useful, as sad and as unfortunate it is, sort of coming at different perspectives can help. And like Amanda mentioned, like the welfare side of things knows one part, the policy side knows another. So just combining all of them, I think, can help the enforcement that we don't really have as a holistic measure right now.
I just want to also add one little thing. This is a lot. Unsanctioned racing can be cultural. And there was recently a raid in Idaho that swept up a bunch of folks, and they're all Spanish language speaking flyers and stuff. And DHS showed up as well. So I think there's a lot of sensitivity right now around that. So that also kind of puts trying to stop unsanctioned racing in a difficult position because, you know, you don't want to see...
I'm going to back you up on that, Amanda, because okay. When we talk about these races, I think people are thinking of like people skulking around, beating horses over the head. And it's all these like scary, cartoonishly evil people. But they're family events and people bring their families and there's kids there. And it's just a day at the fair for a lot of these folks that are attending these races, especially if they don't know the difference between a sanctioned right. and unsanctioned race. And so when we talk about DHS going and scooping up people at these things and it becoming kind of a sensitive topic culturally, we do want to make sure that we're enforcing the unsanctioned racing part and not putting families at risk if,
right.
you know, this isn't the time or place to be getting deep into that conversation, but it is definitely a part of the topic to be considerate of.
So, Amanda, I'm going to wrap up by asking you, tell the audience what they can do to help us to address this issue. You got some suggestions for people at home who are listening and are thinking, boy, that sounds bad. What do I do?
Well, the biggest thing listeners can do is not dismiss this as casual or cultural racing. What we're seeing today isn't just harmless tradition. It's turned into an unregulated commercial enterprise that puts both horses and people at serious risk. If you see events like Emily and Julie mentioned being promoted that lack oversight, safety protocols, or transparency, take that seriously and report it to the appropriate authorities. A lot of these, you'll see these flyers pop up on social media. You just have to know what to look for. It took me a very little amount of time when I was doing my research for my presentations to find these race flyers all over Facebook and Instagram. And once you find one, you just plug in similar search terms and hundreds more pop up. So tips matter, especially in rural areas where these events just blend into the landscape. You can also help by supporting enforcement, welfare standards, and the organizations that are working to draw a clear line between legitimate racing and illegal operations. One closing thought I'd like to leave listeners with, if regulated racing doesn't define its own boundaries, illegal operators will, and they won't do it with the horse's welfare or the industry's future in mind.
Excellent way to close. We really appreciate both of you being here today. If you have further questions or you want to learn more about this, feel free to reach out to Amanda. She's A Cadillac, which is K-A-D-I-A-K, pronounced just like the car, at horsecouncil.org, or drop a note to info@horsecouncil.org.
I'm going to spell it right, though. It's A-K-A-D-I-L-A-K @horsecouncil.org.
Nope. Did I miss it? Okay.
You jumbled it a little, but that's okay. I was going to let it ride.
Okay. No worries. Well, thanks, ladies. We really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So our legislative and regulatory update is brought to you by Smart Equine. Smart Equine is here to help you bring out the best health and performance in every horse. We empower trainers, barn managers, and other industry professionals to help their horses thrive with expertly formulated supplements and thoughtfully designed wellness products. Backed by veterinarians and top trainers alike, they blend science and real-world horsemanship for consistent results that you can count on. Whether your goals are to train for a competition or to support the horses you know and love, you can count on Smart Equine to support your every step of the way with one-of-a-kind solutions to meet each and every horse's unique needs.
For today's legislative and regulatory report, we're covering a long-term project we've had our student intern, Megan O'Brien, building on tariffs and trade. It's kind of the day of student projects that we're going over. We get really excited about our intern projects, so hopefully you don't get tired of hearing us talking about them. And unfortunately, Megan was unable to be here today, but we're really excited because she's going to be presenting this project at our conference in Washington, D.C. on June 22nd. So please come listen to her. And she gave us talking points, so I hope this doesn't sound too much like an economics lecture, but tariffs and trade directly impact the cost of riding, owning, and running a horse business.
At a high level, Emily, why does trade policy matter to the average person in the horse industry?
So it directly affects affordability and access, which is something we worry about a lot at the Horse Council. The equine industry contributes about $177 billion to the U.S. economy and supports over 2 million jobs. And when trade policy shifts or just kind of becomes very unpredictable, those impacts ripple across everything from tack prices to show participation. And one of the key concepts in this project is understanding trade deficits and surpluses and how they operate kind of in context of the industry.
And that context matters. It's really important. A deficit is not inherently negative. In many cases, it reflects efficiency, importing goods that are less expensive to produce elsewhere.
And that kind of helps the overall cost of stuff. We see that most clearly in equipment. The U.S. imports far more saddles and helmets and other gear than it exports. And the majority of countries it comes from is China and other East Asian countries. And that keeps costs a lot lower, but it also introduced this kind of policy risk we're seeing.
So what is the actual concern from a policy standpoint?
It's concentration. So when supply depends on a small number of countries, like it's doing now with our clothes and our saddles and our boots and things like that, the industry becomes really vulnerable to tariffs and other kind of major geopolitical shifts and supply chain disruptions. And we saw that more broadly in 2025 than any other point in time. So tariffs and trade policy changes really hammered hard across multiple sectors at once. And it contributed to a lot of shifts in import volume and pricing and supply chains kind of across the entire industry and across the entire country, all sectors, all industries. We saw such a drastic drop in imports in 2025 that it was lower than during COVID for many sectors across the equine industry. And this led to huge supply issues we're seeing right now. And I think we can all say we've seen prices of everything go up.
Right. And because this equipment is essential, those costs increase directly affect participation and access.
Right, totally. We talk about barrier to entry and making sure everyone kind of has equal access to jump into the horse industry. And the last thing we want to see, especially when talking about participation in the horse industry, is things getting more expensive. And at the same time, talking about all of this, there are areas where the U.S. has a really clear trade advantage. And two of those areas are hay and live horses. And so even though that's really exciting, that means we're exporting more hay and more live horses than we're importing. That doesn't necessarily mean we're seeing lower prices when we're buying that stuff stateside.
Why is driving exports in hay? What is driving that?
It comes down to resources and infrastructure. So how we're making hay and what we have to produce hay. The U.S. has a really strong production capacity, even though over the last 30 years or so, we've seen a pretty significant drop in production. But particularly for alfalfa, it's still exported at much higher levels than is imported. And that ties directly into global demand. So countries like Saudi Arabia and China rely on U.S. hay because they struggle to make their own. And however, that doesn't necessarily mean everywhere across the U.S. sees a surplus of hay that's being exported. Hay availability in the U.S. is very region specific, and costs locally are kind of hugely impacted by a lot of things like drought, water availability, cost of fuel, which I really don't want to think about getting into right now.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So now talk about live horses. Do they follow a similar pattern, although the dynamics are a little bit different?
Yeah, so a lot of this reflects the movement of horses for temporary purposes, like international competition. When we're pulling information from the database, the U.S. trade database, it doesn't necessarily say if a horse is being imported or exported for temporary reasons, because you pay the bond, unless you have one of those year-long ATA carnets, which I think we've mentioned before, but you can check out on our website. Unless you have that year-long, like, tariff passport bond, you're paying the bond every time that horse exports. So if they're bouncing back and forth a lot, it counts in the database as one. So the U.S. produces really high quality sport and performance horses, and they're globetrotting everywhere to go to horse shows. And so, again, a lot of those exports are horses traveling to shows and racing and seasonal competition circuits, just not permanent sales.
So from a policy point of view, what does that imply?
It reinforces the importance of maintaining access to international markets, which we talk about a lot, especially in terms of importing and exporting horses, and minimizing barriers to movement, which is like one of our number one topics, right, with APHIS. So we're heading off to our annual USDA APHIS stakeholder meeting to discuss policies that directly affect horse import and export because it's such a huge part of our industry.
There's also a category that does not fit neatly into deficit or surplus, which is breeding and genetics. Why is that different from a traditional trade pattern?
So that is really interesting because it seems, just based on the data we're seeing, that it's driven by quality rather than direct cost of producing that thing. So as we've started producing embryos, the process to produce embryos has actually gotten a little cheaper. But what we're seeing in terms of the reported values is that the value of them reported is going up. So when semen and embryos are imported and exported for specific bloodlines, they're considered higher value. And so one of the key trends is that we're seeing these higher value imports, especially of embryos, but at lower quantities. So even when quantities are fluctuating in the trade database, the value is still rising, which is pointing to what we think is an increased focus on better genetics and quality of genetics.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So we've talked a lot about the trade side of the equation. How do tariffs fit into all of this?
Right. So they just blanket statement, they increase costs. And not just for imported equine goods or imported horses, but for other material costs like steel and lumber and fuel. And changes in these different items raise prices across the industry. So even when they're not directly tied to horse-related goods, we feel it everywhere.
Yeah, and I know we're probably not saying anything people don't think are, you know, intuitively obvious. Like, all this just increases cost and makes things more expensive. But the current policy environment is also creating some uncertainty.
Yeah, particularly around tariffs. And one of the worst things for trade and economic vibrancy, so to say, is uncertainty. The markets don't know how to handle when things are unpredictable. So recent legal developments have really raised questions about how the current tariffs are applied, how the previous tariffs are applied, whether refunds may be issued, who qualifies for refunds. And it's creating a lot of volatility in pricing, and it makes it very difficult to plan for if you're importing or exporting goods.
I can honestly say we're getting quite a number of phone calls right now about the refund question. And I think that's going to take a while to kind of figure itself all out.
Yeah, yeah. And we did put an update on our website about that. So if you're out there and you have questions about if you qualify for a tariff refund, check out our website, horsecouncil.org. But it's one of those things where when we're talking about tariffs, trade deficits and surpluses really need to be evaluated in context. And that's what this project does. Megan has done a ton of hard work looking at all the individual things. We have a stakeholder meeting about it coming up to make sure we're evaluating all the right data points. And the industry really depends on a lot of imports to maintain affordability and a lot of exports to sustain this kind of economic strength. So when we're talking about legislative and policy decisions, it really impacts both sides of that balance.
Yeah. And I have to say that it really shocked me when we did some of this, when Megan did this analysis to see some of the products that are imported. And who knew that the largest number of horseshoes come from the Netherlands? I mean, there were things that came out of this analysis that were just really eye-opening.
Yeah, Netherlands and Austria, I think. So when we're talking about This is an easy one to talk about. When we're talking about immediate impacts of tariffs, the majority of the horseshoes in this country are imported and the majority of farrier tools are imported. And so you're going to see with that, what was it, a 20% added tariff on steel, iron, aluminum, and specifically horseshoes. You're going to see that in your next shoe appointment with your farrier. We talked to the farriers and they said they see a lot of people, a lot of farriers will have to immediately raise their prices by $20 minimum per shoeing.
Wow. So if you want to explore this more in detail, like we said earlier, Megan will be presenting the full analysis at our conference, which is being held at the Omni Shoreham Hotel. And the conference runs June 21st through the 24th. And Megan's presenting on Monday, the 22nd.
And we'll walk through the data and policy implications in depth and what it means moving forward. And we're just really excited. We're going to have one-page reports to give out and full white paper reports. And we're really excited to talk about because we don't think something has been done. This has been evaluated for our industry at this level yet.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us today and hearing our legislative and regulatory report. And stay tuned for further updates from some of our interns. If you weren't aware, every semester we have somewhere between 6 and 8 interns, and they work remotely and they work on some great research projects for us. And we really rely on them and they do a tremendous amount of work for us. And we're very proud and very pleased to have all of those students. Thank you for joining us today. We'll provide more numbers and links in our show notes. We invite you to support our beloved industry and join the American Horse Council. You can earn a free subscription to our monthly newsletter and some major equine publications, which shares the latest in all our legislative happenings, both federal and state, as well as more information that horse owners like you probably need to know.
And you can follow the American Horse Council on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can also subscribe to this podcast RSS feed. You can subscribe to Horses in the Morning on any podcast player and find all the shows, including ours, on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com.
As we like to say, we are #HereForHorses. Thanks for listening.